Hi, and welcome to The Last Man Standing, here with me, Paul Stevenson. On this Sunday, the 27th of April, 2025, welcome to the show, everyone. And of course, do go and support us at Republic Broadcasting Network, republicbroadcasting.org. And you'll see the various options there to donate, including postal orders, debit card, credit card, and PayPal. So just go there. That's Republic Broadcasting Network, republicbroadcasting.org. And you can easily navigate to the various options available. Okay, so I'm joined with Patrick. Welcome to the show, Patrick. Patrick Slattery.
Well, thank you very much. Hey, what are we going to do when we have no more Skype?
Yeah, well, we'll have to figure something out, obviously. We'll have to find some sort of solution to the new Teams, which seems to have some sort of issues with recording. Unlike Skype, we can record the show. And by the way, this is a pre-recorded show, but it's 1:30 p.m. here in the afternoon, so it's only six and well, what 5.5 hours. Earlier than what my show would be airing live, so we're up to date pretty much. I can't imagine anything too dramatic happening in the next 5.5 hours that we'll miss. You never know, but I doubt it. So yeah, we're recording this Sunday the 27th. I guess that's central time. That is what's 7:30 a.m. central time, whereas the show will air at 1 p.m. central. Okay, so well, as ever, there's a lot going on. Just as a broad topic, and there was or some, you know, general topics that we can hope to get to. There was a big blast in Iran, a port in Iran yesterday. 25 dead, 800 injured, and this was a depot. A fuel depot for receiving fuel, I believe, from China, which is used for missile production, or part of the aspects or the elements that's required for missile, not launching, but missile propulsion or something. So anyway, this fuel was used in, you know, for missiles and production of missiles. So I imagine, even though it hasn't been confirmed, I imagine this was an Israeli operation. of course, the Americans met the Iranians yesterday, and then there's another meeting scheduled for the 3rd of May. But it's interesting timing if there was any progress yesterday. And I'm not sure. I was away yesterday at a theological seminar, an eschatological seminar yesterday on the Book of Revelation down in the famous Metropolitan Tabernacle down in London yesterday. So I don't know what came out of that meeting, but this would be typical of the Israelis trying to scupper any kind of peace process. But we'll see what happens there. And then I believe on Friday, Witkoff met the Russians again. And again, you've always got this split between, you know, the usual suspects and the divide, you know, with this Kellogg idea, and then you've got Witkoff and Trump, who are much more aligned to essentially relinquishing any kind of demands on the Russians, which the US or and nobody else are in any position, particularly not the Europeans or Zelensky, to be making the kind of demands and digging in and not accepting this deal and that deal, and including even Crimea. So there is talk. I was listening briefly to Mercurius last night, and it looks like, on the one hand, you know, you have the Witkoff Trump camp, who seem to be just happy to, you know, acknowledge everything that the Russians want. And like I said, what else can they do? I mean, you know, there's nothing they can do. And even the Europeans now, I think, are starting to, gingerly, you know, sort of tiptoe out the back door. And if Mercurius is right, the Russia or the Americans are talking about lifting the sanctions on Russia, And they might have put the pressure on the Europeans, because these, I think the Europeans will even entertain this idea. I'm not sure, Patrick. I don't know why you know anything more equivocal than I do at the moment. But it's always very difficult in the Trump campaign, or the Trump administration, because there's always different camps. There's always different views. There's always one thing said on a Saturday and another thing said on a Sunday. Everything's always changing, and you never really know what's happening. You know, Trump has got like a kind of a Tourette syndrome where, you know, anything can come out of his mouth at any point. So I don't know really what's going on there. And then, of course, we were talking off air. We're going to play this clip from Jimmy Dore. We're talking about just how prominent Jews are for their small demographic. And obviously we criticize them and for the destructive and overreaching power that they yield. But also, even like in quote, the good guys who are Jews, they're also very prominent as well. You know, the Jeffrey Sachs and Max Blumenthal, and they're the complete opposite. I mean, they are kind of almost the reincarnation of, Mother Teresa or something. But they're also very prominent. You know, Jeffrey Sachs, he's out there in big forums and talking to big audiences. Max, not so much, but he's still pretty prominent. And we speculated that maybe these guys, if it's not, and I agree with you, I don't think Jews organize everything where they're in control of everything, even among their own community. But I think these guys serve a purpose to deflect any criticism of Jews, because, you know, you can point to Israel like Jimmy Dore here and what this clip will illustrate, but they're very reluctant to ever discuss a wider ubiquitous problem within Jews generally. But people are now permitted, because of the, you know, what's happening in Gaza, to criticize Israel and the Zionist, plan for greater Israel and all that. But in this clip, it really demonstrates how they don't want to go any further than that when it comes to criticizing Jews. And it's almost as if, I don't think it's necessarily planned that way. But when you have these prominent good guys like Jeffrey Sachs and Max Blumenthal and Aaron Matze, and there are others, you know, I guess you can point to those guys and say, well, how can you criticize, you know, Jews and say this is a Jewish problem when really it's a Zionist problem? Because, you know, we've got Max Blumenthal and Jeffrey Sachs out there. Look what they're doing. I mean, these guys are the salt of the earth, you know.
Well, there's honestly, I wonder sometimes how much Jews themselves even understand their own power structure. And so there was a clip that Dr. Duke was telling me about, and this was, I haven't seen the whole thing, but Jeffrey Sachs was saying that, you know, the problem is not Judaism, the problem is Zionism. He's making that case.
There you go. That's what they're saying. So if you can focus on Zionism exclusively, then you can look the other way. There's no problem with Judaism. That's what I mean. If you've got Jeffrey Sachs actually saying that, that's very interesting. And Max Blumenthal has said something similar to that as well.
It's a feel-good kind of thing, because nobody wants to blame the Jews for everything. I don't want to blame the Jews for everything. But, still, it's just simply inaccurate to say some of these things. It's inaccurate. It's inaccurate to say that Judaism is like a religion of peace, or no, Judaism, this is something that Dr. Duke's really been getting into lately. And you can go all through the Talmud, you can go through a lot of Judaism, and whether you want to say that this is at least somehow derivative of the Word of God or whatever, it's Judaism is not a religion of peace. It's Judaism.
It's not even really a religion in the way people think about a religion. They don't really understand it, because they don't really understand what exactly they're worshiping in there. When we, as Christians, worship, we worship God. We worship the Trinity, you know, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. The Muslims, they worship God as well, and they have their prophets. What is the focus of the worship in synagogues? Wow. it's not what you might think. It's actually the Jewish people themselves. They worship themselves as a deity, essentially.
Kevin McDonald said that this is what he said, the God of the Old Testament is a Jewish gene pool. You know, now, I know that's not literal, but yeah, I mean, what are Jews worshiping? And I've been to a couple of Jewish services in my life, a couple, two or three. I went to a bar mitzvah not too long ago, and it was weird, you know. And of course they have this rabbi and everything that, you know, the rabbi was saying, it's all feely good stuff, because a lot of the people who were at the bar mitzvah, not everybody was Jewish. There was a lot of goys there. And so it's all feel good kind of stuff. But one of the weird things was there was this woman there, a woman that, like, I actually kind of know, cause she goes to the same chiropractor I do. And she's a woman. And, she was giving a talk about how abortion is a Jewish value. It was weird. And this is a bar mitzvah. So this is for a 12-year-old boy. Like, the boys just turned 12. I think that's the age they have it. And so this is like a pre-adolescent boy. And she's there talking about her pregnancy scare when she was in college. And the guy sitting next to me, who was a goy himself, was like, this is really inappropriate. It's weird. And, I went to a service. I was invited by some guy who actually really didn't like me. I don't know why he invited me. But it was when there was some sort of, what was it, a bombing in Mumbai about 15 years ago, maybe 15, 16 years ago. There was in India, there was a few, like the Chabad Lubavitch Center in Mumbai, India, was bombed, and maybe something else. And there was some connection to, was it some connection to Al-Qaeda in Pakistan? I don't really know. But at any rate, I got invited to this service, and there was a few rabbis who were speaking at it. And this was at a Chabad Lubavitch Center. And, but there, you know, there's a lot of people there. There was a guy who was running for governor. There was, you know, like, I think the mayor was there. There was a lot of people who were there. And trying to remember one of the guys was saying, when we face this kind of terror, we need to respond with love. It's like, oh, well, you know, sounds good. Those are good words. We need to respond with love. Well, what did he mean by respond with love? It means we have to love each other. We have to love other Jews. We have to go and we have to light Shabbat candles for old people. And, you know, that was what he meant by respond with love. We have to respond with love for each other. Then another rabbi got up, and he was actually pretty belligerent. And so I've never been to a regular Saturday service. One of these days, because I do have a yarmulke, I'm going to go to a town where nobody knows me, and I'm going to put on a yarmulke, and I'm going to go in and see what they say. But I've been planning on doing that for about 25 years, and it's never happened so far. But I'll get around to it eventually. Anyway, yeah. I'll kick it back to you, Paul.
Yeah. I mean, I will say this. I mean, you know, Christians also, you know, Christians worship the God of the Old Testament. We don't make any distinction, and, you know, between the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament, Jesus. You know. And for good reason, we have good reason for that. But the problem is, you know, the Jews didn't recognize Christ. Of course, they called for his murder. And they basically, you know, they weren't really even God's people in the Old Testament, because they were always rebelling against God. You know, so I think a lot of people make a lot of comments about the Old Testament and this sort of thing. I'm not sure how much they've actually studied the Old Testament, or, you know, rather than just certain passages and then with a certain view in their mind. You can, of course, go through pastors, which will confirm your views. But I just thought I'd say that because, I mean, they were never really God's people in the Old Testament either. They were constantly rebelling and God rebuked them. And then even the early church was just a remnant of, you know, of the people of the Old Testament, if you like, you know. So but anyway, it's, it comes up a lot. I think I'm going to have to address it in more detail, I think, with at some point. Because it's actually got to the point where it's starting to irritate me, really. if I'm quite honest, sort of this conflation that somehow, you know, God's people, or that, you know, the people of the Old Testament, it's just like it goes a bit too far. It's just like as if the Old Testament sort of is some sort of conspiracy for Jewish interests when it's actually a complete indictment against them, you know, for the most part, you know. Like I said, apart from a remnant of Christians or people, or God's people in the Old Testament that actually followed Christ, the rest of them didn't. They rejected Christ and actually, you know, essentially were responsible for murdering him. But anyway, we can maybe discuss that in more depth because it is a big topic. It's not something you can address quickly. But it does irritate me because I don't really want to be associated with it. And in terms of, I don't know, people thinking that we're somehow worshiping the Jewish, you know, it's just not the case. I mean, as I say, Jews essentially.
Sure, you can take as much time as you want to talk about these things.
Nah, because I would have to go through the scriptures actually and pull out stuff. You know, for example, you know, Jesus is in not only prophesied so many times by the prophets in the Old Testament, including his death, including details about his death, including who would be responsible for it, the Jews. You know, so this is all prophesied by the prophets in the Old Testament. But the Jews noticed, for example, some of them noticed, for example, that there seem to be two deities. There are certain passages in the Old Testament where you have a conversation between what, you know, Yahweh and this other being, this other character that God's communicating with, a distinct character, but communicated with in the same status as deity. And the Jews themselves noticed this. In fact, there was a guy, I think his name's Alan Siegel, wrote a book, it's called The Two Powers of the Godhead. Because the Jews themselves, going through the scriptures, you know, they didn't fail to notice this. And so they speculated, who was it? They thought, is this Michael, the archangel? Or, you know, they had different ideas about who this other character was. But they knew there was two of them. And he was referred to in different ways. And for example, in the book of Daniel, when he was prophesying, Daniel was prophesying, he said, and I saw one like the Son of Man riding on the clouds. This is in Daniel. And when Jesus was pulled up in the middle of the early hours of the morning over Easter, we just celebrated, when he was pulled in front of the Sanhedrin, Caiaphas asked him, you know, well, you're here, you know, and there's this whole contentious issue. There were some like Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus who were pro-Jesus, essentially, and they were reluctant to condemn the man. And they said, how do we know he's not the Messiah? And I've heard his teaching. I've never heard anyone teach with such authority. And then there was others. He's a blasphemer, and because he makes himself God and everything else. And then Caiaphas, in his frustration, just outright asked Jesus, who are you? We hear that you have said you make yourself the Son of God. What do you have to say for yourself? Are you the Son of God? And Jesus answered and said to them, you will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds in great glory. And of course, they recognized that passage from Daniel, which was a prophecy about the Messiah. And he tore his garments for blasphemy. And they said, what more of evidence or witnesses do we need? We've heard it from the horse's mouth himself, you know. And then, of course, they proceeded to lobby Pilate and Herod to kill him. So, you know, people think that somehow Jesus suddenly appeared and that there's no connection. Because I've heard people saying, well, you know, it's just like I'm not going to be, you know, getting involved with this Old Testament God. But, you know, Jesus seems to be a cool guy, so I'll follow him there. It doesn't work like that. You can't just pick it up. You know, it is all part of the same story. He's been prophesied in the Old Testament. He was in the Old Testament. There's evidence of two kind of characters in the Old Testament, not just one. And he, Jesus himself, claimed to be this character riding the clouds, which is a claim to deity in the Old Testament. So I understand, you know, obviously I'm not pro-Jewish, obviously. And also people need to understand that up until very recently in the last century, this it's an aberration where this kind of Jewish thing has sort of, you know, got its claws into Christians in a way that it just was not the case for the most part, you know, for the majority of the history of the church, you know. And then, like I said, Judaism themselves, they're very selective about what everything they interpret it in a Jewish-centric, Jewish supremacy way. And they take all these passages to suit themselves in their own context. So, like I said, it's a big discussion, but, you know, a lot of people just sort of like dismiss, and they sort of seem to think that Jesus just suddenly appeared out of nowhere. There are hundreds of prophecies in the Old Testament about Jesus Christ and about how he would die and what he would do and, you know, and his whole ministry and very great detail about his crucifixion, all of which were fulfilled. And, you know, so anyway, it comes up a lot. I understand it seems to come up with people who, you know, are aware of the Jewish thing. And to some extent, they're kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Friendly to Christianity in a way, but seem to conflate, you know, they're conflating Judaism with Christianity, which I resent, quite frankly.
Well, okay, I'm going to bring up, and I don't want to misrepresent him, but Dr. Duke, who's been looking into a lot of these questions in detail, and, you know, he's somebody who his father was a colonel in the military, and he was a geologist, but he was also a Sunday school teacher. So David grew up with this, and but then of course he got a degree in history, a PhD in history, and he's applying a lot of like history techniques to these scriptures. And, you know, with the case of the New Testament, you know, you've got the letters from Paul, and these letters, they were written down from the very get-go, right? They weren't there was no oral tradition of these letters. The letters were written down from the beginning. You know, you could say that they're copies of copies of copies, but they were written letters in their origin. With the much of the Old Testament, it was oral history. I mean, it was oral for generations and generations, for centuries, and then was written down. And it was written down, you know, obviously this is several centuries earlier than the New Testament. And so what Dr. Duke is looking at is like, okay, there with these extra centuries and with the long oral stage of these stories, there is a lot more room for, there's a lot more wiggle room. And that is it so inconceivable that when I guess a lot was written down during the so-called Babylonian captivity. I say so-called just because I said it. And is it unthinkable that that some of it was written down and altered to an extent for reasons of you know, to make the audience, readers. Feel or think a certain thing.
Well, that's the question. You know, if you're talking about Jews altering it, I'm sure they would have made themselves look better than they did. They don't look good. This is what I mean. If you read the Old Testament, you don't come away after reading the Old Testament saying, "Oh, those Jews they're such godly, lovely people." It's an indictment against them. You know, they're burning.
Well, I mean, it's an indictment against them by our values today.
It's not by our values today. It's by the values of God himself at the time, because God made covenants with people and they broke the covenants all the time. So it's not by our values today. You know, it's okay. God was making covenants with these people, and it's recorded in great detail what the covenants are and what was expected of them to be God's people. And they broke it all the time. And you have passages in the Old Testament where God said, don't claim to be my people. You're not my people. You don't behave like my people. You have no business claiming to be my people. You know, and I'm sick and tired of all your false worship and your incense, and it's an irritation to me, and your sacrifices. He said, I don't want sacrifice. I want justice and mercy and faithfulness. You know, he said, because your hands, you know, because you oppress the people and your hands are full of blood. You know, so there's nothing. In fact, you know, the Jews, by the way, they don't read the Old Testament. They read the first five books. And then between the end of the Torah, which they interpret in a very carnal Jewish centric way as a justification for their behavior, the rest of it between the Torah and the rest of the Bible, including the period between the end of the Torah and the New Testament, they don't worship that. They don't read that because it makes them look terrible. They killed all the prophets. They killed they killed all the prophets and then they killed Jesus. So this is why I'm saying. I guess I'm reluctant to go into it too much because to give it the proper treatment it deserves, it is a longer story, because you can't just take certain passages in isolation or whatever and then say, well, there's a Jewish conspiracy.
I'm being followed for some reason by the police, so hold on a second. All right, I guess it's cool now. I guess that wasn't the police. So, sorry. All right.
So
you never know.
It's not a book that they're too happy with. They, you know, it doesn't make them look too good.
If you're talking about
the compilation of the text, you know. Then, you know, that's a whole nother story about, you know, like you said, you've got the letters and there is more, you know, ambiguity when it comes to how we, you know, got the content of the Old Testament and when the books were written and everything else. Now, they were written by the prophets for the most part. But when you look at the whole story between the start of the Bible and the end of the Bible, it's a coherent narrative. Which we trust to the process of inspiration of the prophets and also the compilation of how we got the books. We trust, you know, to the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, you know, which if you're not a believer, I guess that's not an argument that can even be entertained. But there is a coherent narrative that would not be possible without some sort of higher spiritual force. You know, causing these books to be written. And I'm not talking about, you know, someone being in a trance. When we talk about, you know, the prophets writing under inspiration, they were still very much in control of their faculties. We're not talking about some sort of occult writing where your eyes roll back in your head and you're just literally, you know, writing whatever, you know, and then you don't wake up an hour later saying, well, where'd that come from? Oh, that's interesting.
Thank you.
very much in control of their faculties. We're not talking about some sort of occult writing where your eyes roll back in your head and you're just literally, you know, writing whatever, you know, and then you don't wake up an hour later saying, well, where'd that come from? Oh, that's interesting. You know, they were conscious of what they were doing, but they were writing, and the process of inspiration is kind of the Holy Spirit working through it. But there are books out there, but people like Mike Heiser, rest in peace, he died a couple of years ago. He's done a lot of work on that, where he wrote an interesting book called How We Got Our Old Testament. And, you know, he's a scholar of, you know, ancient history and, you know, ancient bibliography and going right back to the early writings and cuneiform and all that type of stuff. But, you know, to get into all that stuff, it's not something you can do, you know, in a couple of hours. It's a hell of a lot of work. It's a whole sort of, you know, area in and of itself. You know what I mean? Time consuming is what I mean.
Yeah. Well, okay. I brought up Dr. Duke, and specifically one of the things he was telling me was, in the Old Testament, there's like numerous references to God commanding the Jews to commit genocide, to wipe out people, whether it's Amalek or others. And you know, on the one hand, like, you know, that sounds pretty bad. On the other hand, David was saying he doubts that a lot of these genocides actually even took place. But that it would be, if you're talking to your own peers, your own group, while they're in, say, the Babylonian captivity or whatever, and you're telling them that in previous generations that they were powerful enough that they could, you know, wipe out all of their enemies, that this might have some sort of value to them at that time. I hope I'm representing him correctly. Because it's possible that I'm not, but what do you make of that?
Well, he's not alone with that. A lot of people will point to those sorts of things. Where you have these passages, by the way, they're not as numerous and as common as people seem to make out. It's just like people seem to make out, you know, in every other chapter, every other page in the Old Testament records, you know, God's just like this sort of angry maniac who's just like itching to wipe people out. It's like they're not that common, where he's telling people to kill people. There is another, and it's kind of, you know, at the time it was more acceptable, I guess, in our, this is even true of Christians today. I guess it's not so palatable or acceptable today, and it's very vulnerable to mockery and things like that. But at the time, for example, in Genesis 6, and it's kind of, I have to say, at least there has been a renewed interest in these passages, because this worldview was largely held by, would have been understood by the early Jews, including the Book of Enoch, which both Peter and Jude allude to. Now, the Book of Enoch was not ultimately considered canonical. I think it did make it into it was in the Ethiopian canon at one point. But it's apocalyptic literature, which talks about the, it talks about the B'nai Hai Elohim, the sons of God, which were kind of, it seems, sort of angelic beings, which left their first abode, which was a spiritual realm, and apparently they mated, they had children with women. So these beings, they're referred to sometimes as the Nephilim, or not the Nephilim, but the Watchers, or the Anunnaki. And as I say, there's a lot of people here. While you have most people still find this sort of stuff ridiculous and is vulnerable to mockery, you also have a lot of people where there's a renewed interest in it to the point of obsession. You see lots of people obsessed with this sort of thing. But anyway, in Genesis 6, it says, when man began to multiply on the face of the land and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful or attractive, and they took as their wives any they choose. Then the Lord said, My spirit shall not abide in man forever, for he is flesh. His days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of man. Came in means like they, you know, they mated with, they bred with them, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, the man of renown. Now, so this is a passage in Genesis 6, which was not, you know, the Jews would have, you know, believed this. The early Christians had this worldview. Now, and the reason I mentioned the Book of Enoch is because the Book of Enoch seems to, pardon the pun, flesh this out. You know, this is a quite sort of enigmatic passage. And the Book of Enoch talks about these characters who basically left the spiritual realm and had children with these, with women, and these children called the Nephilim, which basically means giants, and that they had kind of supernatural powers. They were a mixture of human beings and sort of angelic beings, and they were giants. You know, some of them apparently were 12, 14, 16, 18 feet tall. And these were like some of the mythological characters that we think of today in Greek mythology, for example. Greek mythology, you know, records these or talks about these kind of characters, you know, these big giant figures. I'm trying to think of who Hercules was considered a giant, wasn't he?
No, Hercules wasn't a giant, but you had the Cyclops, you had giants, you had the Titans.
I mean, I kind of lost interest in a little bit.
Norse mythology had the Jotuns also.
Yeah, so there was these, like, mythical figures who were, I'm trying to think what other examples. Well, you had, for example, the whole thing of Goliath, for example, was apparently a descendant of these characters. You know, you have the story of David and Goliath. And there are these other giant figures. By the way, apparently, I don't know what credence you can give to this, but apparently when the U.S. Navy SEALs were in Afghanistan and they were up in the mountains, there is testimony from Navy SEALs that apparently one of these giant figures appeared out from a cave in Afghanistan and they killed it. And it was immediately, you know, the deep state and the deep intelligence services escorted this creature away, and that they were all sworn to silence and had to sign what's the word when you sign the something where you're not allowed to talk about it, whatever. Anyway,
non-disclosure agreement.
Yeah, but in recent times some of these guys have come out and have said that this is, they witnessed this and stuff, so whatever it's worth, I don't know. Anyway, so these tribes that God said go in and wipe them out, apparently it was understood at the time that these were not normal people, that these were remnants of these hybrid Nephilim characters, including their children. And of course, this was seen in the Book of Enoch, says this, that God saw this as an abomination. This was not part of his creation. This was a rebellion where these creatures, you know, these beings left their spiritual realm and rebelled against God. And the Book of Enoch said, were these beings, knowing that they had sinned against God and what they had done was, you know, leaving them open to serious judgment, they asked Enoch to intervene for them, because they wanted to protect their children. So they asked Enoch to go to God and say, could you, you know, not basically wipe them out? And God said no. And so the Book of Enoch talks about that. And God said, basically, no, they've got it coming, basically, you know. So these passages have been understood that God's not wiping out human beings here. He's wiping out what was left of these tribes. And there is, although again, it's not 100% clear even from Genesis 6, but there's even the possibility that part of the motivation for the flood was to wipe these creatures out. And then God started again with Noah. Now, again, I mean, you know, if people are listening to this in our modern day, Patrick, and talking about this, it's like, you know, people are going to say, listen, you're crazy, you know, this is all just complete insanity. But this is, you know, this was understood not just by the Jews at the time and the early Christians, but Christians throughout history have believed this. And then it got lost. I guess as time progressed, this was kind of seen as, in fact, Christians are a little bit, I don't think any of the reformers, when I was down at the Metropolitan Tabernacle yesterday, the reformers would dismiss this out of hand as well, because they find it kind of, they're uncomfortable with the idea that there was these spiritual beings that, bred with women and created these giant figures and stuff. But I'm just telling, I'm just putting it out there. And if you go on the internet and type in the Anunnaki, or on YouTube, or the some, you know, or the Nephilim, there are people who are, preoccupied to the point of obsession with this whole topic, And serious scholars like Mike Heiser, he's a PhD in, in Old Testament studies and ancient texts and all that type of stuff. He believes all this sort of stuff, and he was partly responsible for resurrecting this kind of worldview that was accepted within Christianity at an early stage. So for what it's worth, but you can imagine when people bring up these things, it's a difficult thing for someone in my position to talk about, to defend, Have some sympathy for me, Patrick, will you?
Well, I am a novice when it comes to this type of biblical scholarship, and not even a novice. I'm just kind of a non-entity. The problem is
it's very time consuming. I remember, and I've interviewed Mike Heiser two or three times. I have to say, I was very upset when he died. He died young. He died. I was quite shocked because I hadn't spoken to him for 2 or 3 years, and I was going to contact him to do another interview again. And I contacted, and he was only about, at that point, I think he had only about 3 months to live, and I wasn't even aware that he had cancer. But he did a lot, and in like 15 years, he wrote a lot of books and became very, very popular and influential, particularly from resurrecting these type of views that were accepted, in earlier Christian, in earlier Christianity. He wrote a book called The Unseen Realm. He's also written a book, How We Got the Old Testament. So, he did a lot in the last 15 years of his life. So, but it's a shame. I feel bad for his family. He had a young family. But anyway, so that's that. How long have we got? Because I didn't intend to talk about all this stuff, but there we are.
We've got another 10 minutes.
All right. So, anyway, this idea about Zionism is the problem and not Judaism. Well, Henry Ford and plenty of other writers historically were writing about the problems with Jews long before there was any state of Israel, So have we got time where I'll play that clip with Jimmy Dore?
Please do.
Okay. Now, this is about Jordan Peterson, the pretentious charlatan, the overly loquacious, whiny sounding Jordan Peterson, basically, criticizing, well, not criticizing, but in the context, he's friends with another Zionist mouthpiece, Douglas Murray, who went on and kind of embarrassed himself on Joe Rogan. And then Peterson went on there talking about how we need safeguards. Peterson suddenly become a bit woke, Anyway, this clip was sort of encapsulated what I'm talking about.
That's the hardest thing to do. We gotta go to war. It's always the solution when the bottom drops out of the pyramid scheme.
So here's what Glenn Greenwald said. He says, so many longtime champions of independent media now subtly mimicking the most sanctimonious corporate media mavens. Rogan doesn't have sufficient editorial guardrails. As soon as he hosts Israel Critics. This show needs more vetting. Too much unfettered discussion.
Why don't you invite them to be guardrails, and then Jordan and Douglas Murray could be guardrails?
They did. Right? He brought
you
out
could
Douglas
be the guardrails, but you're not. You're going, you got to stop this.
You got to stop it. Douglas Murray was right there. He's had on Gad Saad. He's had on Douglas Murray. He's had on Elon Musk. He's had on the biggest Israel cuck of all, Donald Trump. Dr. Rich Voss. That's just off the top of my head that he's had on in the last few months. top. But he brought on Dave Smith, and oh my God, psychopath.
If that is his name. If that is his real name.
If that's his real name. So this guy says, like, Cerberus in Greek mythology. Is that how you pronounce it?
Cerberus.
I'm not well read. How do you say it?
I like that better, Cerberus.
Cerberus? Okay. Yeah. I like Cerberus.
Me too.
Like Cerberus in Greek mythology, the multi-headed guardian dog of the Judeo-Christian asylum patrols the culture scene and makes sure that no one leaves the world of the dead. They use obfuscation, confusion, and fake sophistication or complexity, classic sophistry, to sow doubt and hide the plain and bright light of the truth and morality. He's got it. This guy's nailing it. Murray, Patterson, Sam Smith, Bill Maher, and many others, they're all different heads of the same monster, dog guarding the same civilization of the dead. Well said. So he's retweeting this and Andrew Torba, who says Peterson is on the Rogan today. He's there to try and gaslight Joe into gatekeeping the quote psychopaths who dare to criticize Israel and from being on.
Okay, so by the way, that part there, the tweet actually says who dare to criticize Jews and Israel, and then Jimmy Dore just skipped over the Jews part, but then you just listen.
His show.
You see, if you say Jews in Israel, I think that's a real big mistake.
I think that's a mistake.
Very too. Questionable.
Yeah.
Like, why are you saying that? You see what the problem is, and the people that you tell me are bad, they're trying to conflate those two things.
Yeah. I don't conflate Jews with Zionism. I don't conflate Jews with Israel. Most of the Jews I know are against Zionism, and they're against what Israel's doing, the Greater Israel Project. What's that?
Most of them don't live in Israel.
And most of them don't live in Israel, and they feel.
Yeah, so, I mean, Jimmy Dore just skipped over when he was reading out the tweet this guy had said, who dared to criticize Jews and Israel. And then his colleague here obviously noticed that Dore had skipped over the word Jews and Israel. And then they basically were, you know, outlined what we were talking about. You know, they're making this big distinction. Well, you know, the Jews, most of them don't live in Israel. They don't support Zionism. So Zionism bad, Jews good, you know.
Well, did anybody say colonialism bad, whites good? I don't think anybody ever said that.
No distinctions made there. We were all part of that, actively participating in it, Patrick, you know.
Did anybody ever say patriarchy bad, men good?
No, these distinctions are not made, no.
Yeah. I mean, all I want to do is be able to criticize Jews the same way I've been criticized. My group, my people have been criticized my entire life. And except when I say I just want to do it the same way, I don't want to do it the same way. I want to do it in a more rational, level-headed, objective way. But I still want to be able to, I want to subject them to critique.
It's symptomatic of the hypersensitivity around the topic.
Yeah.
That's the thing. You know, people are so hypersensitive about it. I've had these discussions with people before. It's like, if there's no Jewish conspiracy, well, why are you freaking out so much, you know? You know, what are you scared of? You know, because I've had people before who really want to distance themselves from it. In fact, I mentioned Mike Heiser earlier. He's one of them. We and him had an argument because he got wind of my views on, you know, the Jewish aspect. And he actually put a public notice up that he wouldn't have me on a show again. Now we made up after that, but he felt the need to make a public statement because he was working in universities and no doubt surrounded by Jews, and he was probably worried about losing his job. And I remember saying to him, like, you seem very sensitive to this point. What's the problem if there's no Jewish conspiracy? Well, there's no Jewish conspiracy. Aren't we all entitled to our opinions? Why are you freaking out about it? If they haven't got the power that I'm saying they have, why do you feel the need to make a public statement, distance yourself from that view and distance yourself from me, a brother in the Lord?
While we have 2 minutes left, I'm just going to point out Norman Finkelstein, who's, you know, a Chomsky. He's got his own I got some areas of disagreement with him, but I really respect his work. But regarding Zionism, he doesn't use the term Zionism. He says anybody who's got enough money, any Jew who has enough money to buy a one-way ticket to Israel and hasn't done so, you can't call them a Zionist. And what he's saying is you can't blame this on the Zionists. There are all these rich Jews. He's using the term Jewish supremacist now. There are all these Jewish supremacists who are responsible for these policies that we're talking about.
Yeah, well, let me just finish with this. Let me just finish with this from Henry Ford. And this was obviously written well before the State of Israel, although the Zionist movement had begun. It wasn't the main focus of Ford's writing. He said, Judah has begun the struggle. Judah has made the invasion. Let it come. Let no man fear it, but let every man insist that the fight be fair. Let college students and leaders of thought know that the objective is the regnancy of the ideas and the race that have built all the civilization we see and that promises all the civilization of the future. Let them also know that the attacking force is Jewish. That is all that will be necessary. It is against this that the Jews protest, quote, "You must not identify us," they say. You must not use the term Jew. Why? Because unless the Jewish idea can creep in under the auspices of other than Jewish origin, it is doomed. Anglo-Saxon ideas dare proclaim themselves and their origin. A proper proclamation is all that is necessary today. So, you know, he understood the situation, and they do a lot, whether it's Zionism or, you know, mixing themselves up with white supremacy when it suits them, you know. So that's where we are. I mean, you know, Ford was well ahead of his time in many ways, you know.
Indeed. Well, I guess that's all the time we have.
Yes. Okay. Thank you for joining me, Patrick. I'll be back again next Sunday. So until then, take care and God bless.